Scientific and Medical Network, and a great honour to follow my friend, because what a carpet of wealth of knowledge and wisdom she's spread before us. Thank you, Anna. I want to begin by telling a story. In 1982, I set up the Oxford Research Group with the explicit idea of finding out how nuclear weapons decisions are made and who makes them, because the process at that time was completely secretive, unaccountable, and nobody knew what was going on until it was just announced that we were having a new series of nuclear weapons. And so it took us 4 years to publish our first book, which was called How Nuclear Weapons Decisions Are Made, the first of about 43, I think, so far. And then began the really difficult business of getting into dialogue with people who held these heavy responsibilities. The physicists who were designing nuclear warheads, the intelligence people who were supplying the threat information, the military who were strategizing with the nuclear weapons, the defense contractors who were building the so-called platforms, and last and very last, the politicians who were rubber stamping basically what was a process that was already underway before they came into office. And our mission was not to demonize such people, but to really understand them and to bring them into dialogue with people who were well informed enough to hold their own in a serious discussion. And gradually, over, it took another 5 or 6 years, we began to be able to invite these individuals from all the nuclear nations. We're not just talking about Britain, we're talking about what was then the United States, the Soviet Union, France, China, and Britain. And then we went on to research India and Pakistan and Israel. But at this stage, we were bringing those individual decision makers, many of them refused to come, but those who did, we welcomed at Charney Manor, that's the Quaker Retreat Centre just outside Oxford. It was very important to develop a safe enough container, and everybody here will know what I mean by that, to enable people to really listen to each other and not just stand on their positions. Because those we were bringing were, say, the chief weapons warhead designer from Los Alamos to meet his counterpart from Russia or China, whom he had never met. And I say he advisedly because out of 650 policymakers that we identified, 5 were women. But he would also be meeting a very informed series of critics, people who had been in the business and then opted out, like Frank Barnaby, who was a warhead designer at Audemars and who became the head of the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. So we were welcoming into this beautiful room. It was a vaulted chamber. It was called the Solar at Charney Manor, and it's on the first floor. And underneath it is a library, right underneath it. And because I had by that time started to meditate and was very convinced of the positive power of meditation without really understanding it, I asked 5 of the strongest meditators I knew to come and sit in the library below and meditate all day. And at one of the meetings, the second morning, somebody from the US State Department came to me and he said, "Scylla, this is a very special room." And I said, "Yeah, it was built in 1360. And he said, no, it's very special. And I said, "Well, people have been meeting here, doing yoga in this room, discussing for many, many years." And he said, "No, there's something coming up through the floorboards." And I said, "Well, yeah, you're right. Do you want me to tell you what it is?" And he said, "Yes." And so I told him. You would have thought I'd slapped him. He said, "I don't believe you." I said, "Well, please ask those older people who serve you your lunch. It's them." And he did. And the next time I saw him, he had a kind of shy smile at the edge of his mouth. And I said, you just watch what happens. And he did. And during that meeting, as in others, we were able to begin to lay the foundations of later treaties. But everything was completely off the record. No press, no reporting. That's why you never heard about it. So I mention that story because it sort of explains my passion, which is to be a bridge. I love Anne's image of the bridge in her slides, because I believe it's necessary to try and be a bridge between the personal and the political, between the psychological and the strategic, between the inner and the outer. Because I believe that it's allowing those very, in quotes, opposite things to inform one another that lies the way forward. And I'd like, if I may, to to tell you, first of all, what I'm going to try and cover in the next 40, 50 minutes, and start by saying, well, our world obviously faces multiple crises, and I don't have to spell them all out for an audience like this. But the ones that have hit me particularly in writing this book are the extent to which the rich-poor gap is getting wider. The 300 richest people in the world now have more wealth than the 3 billion poorest. that's nearly half of humanity. And we know that forests are disappearing on a daily basis. Oceans are literally being vacuumed of fish. And these disastrous crises lurch through the financial markets. And Einstein said that no problem can be solved from the consciousness that created it. So what is, and this is what I want to address today, what is the current shift in consciousness that's required to enable us to resolve global problems at the root? To, in the title of our meeting this weekend, to envision and embody a new world. So what I'm going to try and do is address the following points. What is this new consciousness and how do you recognize it? How does it work in terms of leadership? What are the stale values that we've had that have produced a lot of these crises? And what values do we need to replace them with? This will be very close to David's work, I imagine. How are these values becoming evident? What examples do we know of these new values becoming evident? How is transformative leadership developed? And how fast is this leap happening? And is it happening fast enough? So, what is this new consciousness? Well, everybody in this room, I think, will have a different version of it. But I will just tentatively put forward what I've dug up for myself. And it springs a lot from what Edgar Mitchell said. You'll recall that he was a very bright young US Navy captain who became the modular pilot for Apollo 14, making him the sixth person to walk on the moon. And on his return trip, as he watched the Earth float freely in the beauty of space, he realized that the story of ourselves as told by science, what he called our cosmology and our religion, was incomplete and likely flawed. He said, I recognized that the Newtonian idea of separate, independent, discrete things in the universe wasn't a fully accurate description. What was needed was a new story of who we are and what we're capable of becoming. So what exactly is this new story that Mitchell's talking about and that Anne's talking about? What are human beings capable of becoming? As far as I can see, this is not just a shift in consciousness, but it's a leap in consciousness. This is not a gradual thing. This is a leap. And it's a leap into a fundamentally different way of perceiving ourselves and perceiving the world we inhabit. And it will alter everything. And I think there are a great many aspects to this leap in consciousness, but perhaps four essential elements. The first one is perspective. And that's obvious from that beautiful image that the lunar pilots brought back. Our perspective that we are blessed to inhabit this pearl of great beauty, of extraordinary beauty. So that perspective jumps us, leaps us out of the consciousness that we had as residents of suburbia. The second one is interconnectedness, and Anne's spoken a lot about this. But unless we've gone numb and want only to turn a blind eye to what's happening to the Earth, we now realise that we're affecting our own evolution by everything we do. We learned, for example, that the gases produced by refrigerators, we learned this years ago, destroy the ozone layer. And that the thinning of the ozone layer in turn permits harmful ultraviolet rays from the sun to reach our bodies. We learned that and we acted on it. And this kind of awareness, and we're getting more and more of it now, is jarring, it's demanding, but it's real. And it's exciting. It's the most unusual opportunity given to humanity, I think, to move toward what many people call unity consciousness, a direct, intuitive awareness of the oneness of reality. And to me, the third element is the sort of wonderful manifestation of that, and I call it blazing intelligence. And if you look at Anne's pictures of the cosmos, it's nothing but blazing intelligence. And for me, it's actually an oak tree. I live in the very heart of England, where the oak trees, many of them, are allowed to grow to their full size. And if I go and stand underneath one of these, and I see that through this wood, which is so dense and solid that you can hardly get a chainsaw through it, travels huge quantities, tons of moisture upwards, up to the very furthest twig. And at that very furthest twig produces a flower and then an acorn, which falls to the ground with a 400-year business plan. And if that's not blazing intelligence, I don't know what is. And the last one, and there are many, but the last one I would mention, is the balance in this new consciousness between the masculine and the feminine. As Anne's been saying, for 3,000 years at least, power and decision-making in the world has been in the hands of men. And this has brought obvious advantages, enormous ones, in science and discoveries in health and in many fields. But it's also led to an imbalance or what you might call a distorted way of doing things that marginalises essential aspects of human intelligence. When I was researching a book on power and sex in 1995, I found that nearly all recorded thinking on power and the use of power has been androcentric. That is, done by men and based on male values. I searched the shelves for books on power written by women. I could find two. The male norm and the human norm, even today, tend to be thought of as identical. And this has led to this dangerous imbalance between the masculine and feminine, not in this room, clearly, but in almost everywhere in the world. For example, we see women in the city of London and on Wall Street dressing exactly like men except for the high heels. and competing to outperform men in determination, focus, logic, ruthlessness, achievement and drive. So what has become devalued in this way of living are essential elements of being human. The skill of listening, the ability to nurture, to include, the choice to exercise power with rather than power over, the attention to intuition and creative imagination that makes for great art and invention. Bear in mind in your listening here, I'm talking about the deep feminine and the deep masculine in men and women. This is not a gender issue now. The ability to stand in the shoes of another person, the practice of dialogue with our inner world, and the compassion and stamina to look after those who are weak and in need. And above all, reverence for the sacredness of creation and of our bodies. So, moving on, how does this new consciousness work in terms of leadership? And authentic leadership, which is the kind so deeply needed on the planet now, I believe it begins in what I would call the radical mastery of one's inner being. Brilliance, charisma, eloquence, vision, these are wonderful gifts that a leader can possess. But these gifts gain ultimate effect and coherence only when fueled and sustained by inner power. And in half a century of work in the world, the most important lesson I learned from observing people like Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu at close quarters is that inner work is a prerequisite for outer effectiveness. That I would go further, that the quality of our awareness directly affects the quality of the results produced. Any of you who've worked in non-governmental organisations, as I have most of the last 50 years, know that enormous amounts of energy go down the drain through feuding, misunderstanding, fights, jealousies, all sorts of eruptions of the unconscious, completely undealt with and unaddressed in the process of most organisations. So, what I was fascinated with working so closely with these great leaders was that they had this inner power almost as a diamond formed by years of honing self-awareness, practicing selflessness, and observing and controlling the ego. Mandela called Robben Island our university. He did. And if he hadn't gone through his learning about how to treat violent warders without violence, because as you know, Mandela went into Robben Island believing in violence, and he came out 27 years later believing totally in dialogue. But he had to train not only himself, but work with all his colleagues so that they came out as a phalanx of people who were totally committed to opening one's heart to the other without becoming weak, without giving away a shred of their inner power, but that they had that diamond within them of compassion, basically. It was compassion. And the hardest thing he had to do when he came out was not only work with the most brutal government the world has probably known, and I lived there for 10 years, but to persuade members of the ANC, the African National Congress, who hadn't been in jail and who wanted to now to fight. They said, now you're out of jail, we can get all the weapons and money we need, we'll just wipe out the whites. And so what Mandela did was to struggle with them to avoid a civil war, which many people thought would cost 6 million lives. So this inner power is an absolute vital ingredient in my way of thinking in terms of resolving the kind of conflicts we've been talking about earlier. So it's the skill of empathy, even for those who totally oppose you. And it's the humble commitment to keep learning the skills of deep listening and meditation. And it has a physical manifestation. I think it was the second meeting that I was in with Nelson Mandela, and I was sitting about as far as I am from you. And he walked in completely without any fanfare, no ego, nothing. Sat down and started talking straight away. Now, he's not an orator. He has a gravelly voice and no flourishes at all. And as he started speaking, I got goosebumps. 35 minutes later, I still had goosebumps. Now, that was the energetic effect of this man's integrity. When I speak about it, I get the same thing. And so what I'm remarking on, and I think scientists could be investigating this, is the energetic effect of integrity. So what I'm expressing here has been known in all the great spiritual traditions, but it needs to be reclaimed for a secular world in crisis. It needs to be reclaimed for a secular world in crisis and in a language that everybody can understand. Without leaders of this caliber in every sphere and institution of our world, I think our chances of survival are grim. The planet will survive. With such leaders, we can build a world that our grandchildren will be proud of. So I'm certain that a different future is possible for all humanity if humans wake up. And that's not just a little shift, it's a leap. It's big. So, interestingly, this is happening fast now in the corporate world. I was just telling Una that I went to a meeting at I think it's the second biggest investment house in the world, managing trillions of dollars. And the vice chairman got up. This was a meeting about meditation. He got up and he said, "I'm so convinced of the value of meditation for our employees that I've said to everybody that they can take time out in their working day to meditate, and we will make a space for them to do so. Out of 13,000 employees that they have, 1,200, nearly 10%, meditate every day." I was stunned by that. So mindfulness makes the cover of Time magazine and even the Sober Financial Times talks. And in the House of Lords, even there. But waking up means a lot more than sitting quietly in meditation. It means a radical revision of values. And I'd like to present you, and I somewhat hesitate to do this in the presence of so many experts, but I will present you with 10 values or norms that I think have governed our Western actions for centuries and which have contributed to the state of the planet today. And then I'll propose what I think, and we can improve this together, we could replace each of those values with. And these would be values that can enable better decisions and decisions that could get us out of the mess we're in. So you don't need to write this down because it's all in the Huffington Post, actually. I wrote an article on it and it went up into the Huffington Post. So what are these stale values that have caused the present crises? And what values do we need now? First one, humans have the right to do as we like with the earth. The story I would illustrate there is, do you know about this yachtsman, Ian McFedyan, who was sailing his yacht 10 years ago across the Pacific from Japan, I think, to Western United States. And he saw every kind of wildlife, whales, flying fish, dolphins, albatross, the lot. He sailed his boat the same route a year ago. He saw not one living thing. And he wrote about it in the Newcastle Times and it went viral. What he did find was dead young birds landing on his yacht. And when he opened their gullets, they were full of bic biros, or pieces of them, bottle tops, can lids, and they had nothing in their digestive system that they could eat. So, what would we replace that with, that value? It could be what the indigenous cultures have been telling us for centuries. Humans become responsible stewards of the earth in order to preserve its beauty and diversity. Children love that one. They get it immediately. Second one, science and the rational mind are what matter most. Now here I'd like to read you what Sally Dearman Cummings says. She was the first woman to become a pilot of a fast jet in the RAF. She's probably the fastest woman on Earth. And she's very, very bright. And she says, our left brain is now so dominant in our social structure that its landscape is taken as the only or superior reality. We fail to acknowledge just how much it is informed by the right brain. Without the right brain, the left brain would have very little to analyse or present. Its brilliant, clinical, zeros and ones pattern recognition device that is complementary to our right brain. We feel, we resonate with, truth and the amplified field. Here's this pilot of the fastest jet talking about the amplified field. We resonate with the amplified field with our right brain and use our left to notice its effects and make logical deductions that can be verbally expressed and written down. Neither task can be performed by the other. I love that. Our right brain, she says, is ideally developed to read complex, non-linear, non-verbal signals beneath the linear landscape and present that information to us in its own language of emotional, energetic, and physical feelings of coherency, as previously described. The right brain is a richly equipped, reliable, and accurate tool for discerning truth. So, if the old value is science and the rational mind are what matter most, that could give way to the human body, mind, feelings and soul, as Anne has been saying for years, are all one, interacting constantly, and the entire package is consciousness. So moving on to the third one. Continuing economic growth is essential. And there's absolutely no doubt that economic growth has brought hundreds of millions out of poverty and relieved untold suffering across the planet. The question to be addressed is whether this most sacred cow of contemporary economics, one that now dominates entire world culture, can be sustained. Western nations that already have a high standard of living naturally want to keep that standard of living, and developing nations, some of whom are still in survival mode, dream of one day being able to emulate our standards. Nevertheless, it's clear to anyone with access to the internet that the planet's resources, particularly water, cannot support further endless economic growth. So, continuing economic growth is essential, could be replaced with growth in consciousness is now more urgent. Fourth one, survival of the fittest. So dated, and a misunderstanding actually of Darwin. It goes without saying that competition can be a great spur to improvement, can stimulate activity, can be creative, and can help modify behaviour. Nevertheless, as a basic belief system, in recent decades, competition has grown to become like a towering giant wielding a massive club and driving hundreds of millions of humans to run full speed over a cliff. Listen objectively to the news for a week and count how many times reference is made to the unquestioned force of the market, the dominant importance of share prices, the necessity for economic competitiveness, and the unquestioned requirement for growth. Economist Hazel Henderson talks of the poverty-exacerbating global casino, the speculation in oil and commodities that drive up fuel and food prices, leading to deprivation and hunger. And this particular aspect, the survival of the fittest, leads to the legal right, I don't know if you know about this, the legal right that international corporations now have in law to sue governments that pass laws that reduce their profits. That's in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, if you want to go. Exactly. So, survival of the fittest is not going to help us last very much longer. And it could become. It's more efficient to replace competition with cooperation for the greater good. And that's an interconnectedness that I'm observing now all over the planet, politically. And I'll come to that at the end of my talk. Fifth one, very dear to the Foreign Office, good fences make good neighbours. Certainly there is a case for good fences. Humans have a fundamental instinct for territory and a space of our own. And that space can need defending. However, in an increasingly digitalized world, the notion of good fences is becoming quickly outdated as attacks in cyberspace become the strategy of choice. I've got a wonderful story, which is too long to read you now, but I can dig it out later. It's called The Hidden Battlefields of History. And the first known cyber war is piling up the casualties. In the US, many banks have been hit and the telecommunications industry seriously damaged, likely in retaliation for several major attacks on Iran. And Washington and Tehran are ramping up their cyber arsenals, not to mention China, and based on a black market digital arms bazaar, enmeshing such high-tech giants as Microsoft, Google, and Apple. So I'd like to, by contrast, point out what's happening across frontiers. And I suppose the dearest to my heart is Médecins Sans Frontières. There are all these organisations now of extraordinarily brave people who are going out and exercising their skills, whether they're medical, whether they're educational, whether they're technical, across boundaries, and just not allowing themselves to be stopped by borders. So good fences make good neighbours could become building trust is the most effective and least costly form of security available today. Six, another one that's very dear to my government, might makes right. And I'd just like to quote here from a young woman called Emma Skye, who was political advisor to General Odierno, the commander of US forces in Iraq, laterally. And she said, "Some Americans believed Iraq could become a democracy that would serve as a model for the region. Most Iraqis had not consented to this experiment or to being occupied by foreign forces." And today we're seeing the fallout of that. And might makes right has been described as the underlying assumption of totalitarian regimes. However, in my experience working in military think tanks in the West, I should say working with, not for, those who think of themselves as realist scholars of international affairs take it as a kind of norm, might makes right, as the way things work. It's quite shocking when you go into that dialogue and that discourse that might makes right is almost an accepted norm. And those defending the case for military supremacy might vigorously argue that if you're not armed and dangerous, you're a sitting duck. They endlessly quote the example of the Tibetans and the Chinese invaders in 1950. They would ask, what use is non-violence in a brutal world? The response might be that it was Gandhi's insistence on non-violence that eventually drove the most powerful empire the world has seen out of India, and Martin Luther King's similar insistence that ensured civil rights for African Americans. And the Tibetan Buddhist passion for non-violence may not have secured Tibet, but with the Dalai Lama's incandescent advocacy and example, Tibetan Buddhism and its concepts have spread across the planet. So, might makes right could usefully be replaced with common security is safer and cheaper than an international system based on weapons and superior power. And I've got masses of stories to illustrate all these things that I'm saying. Seventh, short-termism is fine. Forget the annual report. These days, shareholders' decisions often hinge on financial analysts' quarterly financial expectations. And with perks, jobs, and bonuses at stake, more and more senior executives are unable to ignore them. Pressure to produce short-term results increased in the 5 years to 2013, according to 63% of global executives who responded to McKinsey's survey. Increasingly outspoken activist shareholders appear to drive today's boardroom decisions to short-termism. Research by INSEAD shows that far from ensuring steady profits, short-termism can be destructive in the long haul. But with a growing number of executive compensation packages rewarding short-termism, it takes courage and willpower to keep the non-immediate future in focus. So I think one of our jobs in this room is to support those leaders who do think long-term, because it's very hard to uphold. So short-termism is fine could become our decisions now take account of future generations, as the oldest indigenous traditions have told us for centuries. They said, whenever you make a decision, think about the effect on the seventh generation. Eighth, the technical fix will always be invented in time to resolve serious problems. Technology has indeed brought untold benefits to humankind. I mean, to list them would take all morning. But this has given us such confidence in technology that we found it easy to forget those advances in specific industries that have been disastrous. Thalidomide. Many examples of technical fixes that have been thought to be the most welcome news, and then we've realised the backlash. And I'm thinking here of the meltdown both at Chernobyl and now at Fukushima, the effects of which we haven't even begun to realise. So the reliance on technical fix can give way to the greater intelligence is not only available to us here and now, but is infinitely more powerful than human intelligence. Now that's something you almost have to experience in order to know that it's true. But when I think about the tiny capacity of my brain compared to the enormity of what I can perceive if I just shut up and be quiet, it is literally mind-boggling. Were reason to prevail, we would capture solar energy and not block it. We would shun fossil fuels. We would not wage ecocidal wars to seize remaining supplies. And we have to observe that in today's world, policymakers have diverted billions of dollars into blocking the sun. And the sun produces in 1 hour enough energy for the entire planet for a year. So hubris is an ancient Greek word, which I rather like. It means extreme arrogance. And wisdom, I would say, is cautionary good sense. And hubris is at the heart of Greek tragedy, as we know. The arrogant belief that one's power is unassailable. Wisdom counsels that no human power is unassailable. And the arrogance of thinking that we can control nature makes me gasp. Try making a pact with a hurricane. Try stopping a volcanic eruption. Try doing a deal with a tsunami or an earthquake so that it won't submerge your nuclear plant. So, second last, women are too emotional to deal with the real issues of business and world affairs. That we don't have to go into because it fades away to become the capacities of the deep feminine and the deep masculine in both men and women are now seen as vital for human survival on the planet. And the very last one, consuming is our right and our addiction, I put in brackets. And I just feel miserable when I go into a shopping mall just because everybody is so unhappy shopping. I know that I love to buy a new piece of clothing and take it home in its tissue paper and take it out and put it on, but it fades very, very quickly, and then I have to go and do the whole thing again. So what we really want to do, what we really desire, is to satisfy the human need for meaning and beauty. This is why I so much like the work being done in schools now. So, getting towards the end of what I have to say, are these values becoming evident? And this is the task, to think in terms of strategies of getting from where we are now to where we want to be. Because as my great mentor, Professor Sir Joseph Rotblat, said, the future belongs to those who can see it. So I'm working with a group of women, older women from all over the world now, including Anne, to develop visions in terms of economics, education, environment, health, food, water, to develop the vision of how the world could be. But we need methodologies for getting from here to there. And so in this book that I've just been writing, I started to look for them. And the more I looked, the more came crowding in. And I wish I had time, maybe in response to questions, to tell you just some of those extraordinary things that are happening. But one in one of the trickiest areas is banking. And I've discovered this extraordinary example in Indonesia, where Felia Salim, who was the vice president of the biggest bank in Indonesia, was asked to tackle the problem that banking had forgotten about people. And so she went for 2 years, traveling all through the archipelago of Indonesia, talking to the elders, talking to village people, asking them what it was they wanted from banking. And she brought all the information back and redesigned the entire bank from the bottom up. And they're just beginning to win prizes for what she did and be acclaimed worldwide. She's turned it into a people's bank. And she's much smaller than me, she's tiny. And and she's just a firebrand. She's amazing. And then there's a man in Japan who's invented a machine to deal with plastic. And do you know about him? He's built this very simple, things looks like a large refuse bin, except it's metal. And it heats up safely, and you can put all your plastic refuse in it, and it melts it and produces cooking oil from plastic. God knows how it does it. God knows why nobody discovered it before, but he's patented it, and it will now be able to... It's cheap to produce, and it will now be able to spread to villages and towns all over the planet. And then, as you will know, the upshot of the internet has been that people power has multiplied exponentially. Anne mentioned Avaaz. Do you know that Avaaz is growing by 1 million people a month? It's now 135 million, I think. So you've got that petition. It's not just petition power, but what Avaaz do is they use humour. They use the money that they're given to design, to commission wonderful cartoons to make fun of politicians who are doing stupid things. And that works far more than anything else. Works better than any petition. And there's so many of these movements now that are relying on the internet, and I'll come back to that in a second before I finish. And then there's this question of how conflict is transformed. And I've been in the business of locating locally led conflict initiatives now since the year 2000, because when I handed over the work on nuclear weapons, I did that because I got fascinated by how local people were taking conflict into their own hands and transforming it. So I sent out a researcher to go and find all the initiatives he could, the reliable, responsible initiatives, where people were actually preventing or resolving or dealing with the aftermath of conflict all over the world. The one condition was they had to be local people. And he found 350, and we wrote up 50 of them in a book called War Prevention Works. That was in 2000, we published it. If we did the same research now, today, there would be five times that many. So, a bit like grass coming up through concrete, green shoots coming up, you know the way it does when it pushes concrete out of the way? You've got these locally led initiatives in every conflict area of the world where people are risking their lives so that other people don't get killed. And the Peace Direct, which is the organisation I set up to encourage and give media support to those people, is now hardly able to cope with all the requests that we have from them. So the last section that I want to talk about is, how is this kind of transformative, authentic leadership developed? Well, as anybody in this room will know, it's a series of very deep and sometimes difficult, challenging personal steps. And I will just spell them out. I wish I could go into them all. But I think it starts with listening to oneself, gaining authenticity because one really knows what one's mission is. Listening to what it is that is the personal passion that will fuel us through getting into action. And that's a very quiet, personal, solitary job. So that goes with developing a practice of reflection and meditation in order to become an observer of the mind. Because unless we can see, and this was clear from all that Anne said, unless we can observe what we're up to and see when the shadow takes over, unless we can wake up to our own darker sides, we can't become really effective leaders. And that's one of the things that Mandela did on Robben Island. The third one is dealing with difficult feelings. Everybody gets overwhelmed by fear at times. And we need to find, everybody needs to find a way of dealing with that fear effectively, getting to the root of it. And I call that actually meeting the dragon. In an experiment we did 2 years ago in Germany on a week-long retreat, I worked with 70 people in a pavilion. And what we did was to find the deepest conflicts that people faced and watch what happened when they were willing to walk towards them instead of saying, not now, which is what we mostly do with our deepest internal problems and conflicts. And when people were willing to walk towards their particular dragon, something extraordinary happened. When they stood quietly in front of this roaring monster of anger, fear, jealousy, hatred, whatever it was, and just held it, in their heart, something always shifted. Just that holding it in the heart. And what they found was that underneath the dragon's foot, if they can just lift up the dragon's foot, is a diamond. And that's a diamond of truth. That's why it's worth working with the shadow. It's got a gem for everyone in it. And it's not easy work. We know that. We've got to increase our well-being and our energy. So we've got to take lots of exercise and eat properly. We've got to use conflict as opportunity. Again, with our colleagues and our workmates and our communities and our families, move towards the conflict. And there's a little book at the back called Peace Begins With Me that has lots of stories and exercises on how it's really, really written for teenagers, but it's a useful guide. That allows us to let our imagination and our creativity flourish, because it's being able to see how life could be different that will beckon us on. And then learning how to serve, because this kind of leadership is definitely servant leadership. And it's moving from what I think was the mantra of last century, which was what can I get, to the mantra of the coming 100 years that we live through is what can I give. It's going to be giving and serving which is going to ennoble the human race again. And this is where I think the strong masculine comes in that you asked about. Because I think there are many now images of this powerful, strong, protective masculine. And I always think of some of the stories of the Round Table, the Valiant Knights. And I love that image of what men, as men, not just as the masculine principle, but as fully fledged men, bring to the protection of the world and the people who are trying to work for its good. So, last remarks, how fast is this happening? If it's essential to human survival, is it happening fast enough? That's the big question. And it seems to me that there are two phenomena happening simultaneously. The first is the disaster that we all know. Humans stripping the earth of its natural resources so fast that entire ecosystems are collapsing as we speak. And most human beings being unaware of the tragedy happening around us. But the second is a fast-growing number of highly energized humans waking up to an entirely new perception of the functioning of the universe and how by working with its energy systems instead of against them, they can assist in the regeneration of the planet. And here I'd just like to give you one example, and that is that I work both with young social entrepreneurs and with some carefully selected big corporations. And when I work with an organisation called the Do School in Hamburg, they ask people to offer a challenge to young social entrepreneurs, whom they then bring from all over the world. There were 2,000 applicants for 20 places. And they offer 8 weeks training to these young, very bright young people from all different cultures in how to organise to do what it is they're passionate about. So all the hardware, how to build a website, how to raise money, how to organise accounts, all those things. And then they get someone like me to come in and talk about the soft skills, how to resolve conflicts, how to develop a truthful culture with your colleagues, how to communicate positively, how to build visions, how to refuel your colleagues when everybody gets exhausted. And the Do School are now so successful, they've become the darling of funders, actually. So they've opened in New York last month, and now they're beginning to contemplate opening in New Delhi, in Johannesburg, and various places across the world. I think it'll spread worldwide. And so this, what I wanted to get at in my very final words, is that the energy of these young people, these young social entrepreneurs, is as contagious as what I talked about with Mandela. Because these are young people who are devoted to serving, they're devoted to the truth, and they have a reality about them that can actually jump 5,000 miles. I've seen them connect up on Skype with people they don't know at all, and in 5 seconds they're talking the same language. Because they're enthused, energized, positive, struggling with the problems they face, but they've got this feeling that not only it can be done, but it's really worth doing. So let me pause there and see if you have any questions.
Thank you so much, Scylla. That really builds on what Anne was talking about earlier on, but in a very practical way. So I should have mentioned the book that you did together, which is called Soul Power, which is at the back too. And I was reminded towards the end of a Churchill quote, which you may know: "We make a living by what we get; we make a life by what we give."
Didn't know that one.
It's a good one. We're very good at these kind of epigrammatic. If you find yourself in hell, keep going. The pessimist sees a difficulty in every opportunity. The optimist, an opportunity in every difficulty. There's a lot of Churchill that's worth memorizing. Anyway, let's have some questions, comments, interaction. And it seems men got their hand up first here. The protective masculine.
Thank you, sir. And this will be a short question. Firstly, would that the talk could have been longer. I loved every moment of it and would relish even more.
Thank you.
My question, one of the things that you touched on in the closing sections was the dragon, which we had earlier. And you mentioned walking towards the dragon, facing it, holding it. Would you elaborate, please, on that process?
I'd be glad to. I really like dragons. I think most of our dragons get bigger and bigger because we ignore them. And maybe I can just illustrate this with a personal story. In a relationship with my partner, we got to a point of crisis, and I was outrageously jealous. I was in that kind of jealousy where you tear the house apart, looking for letters and clues and, you know, really vile. I was completely possessed. I even took everything out of the store cupboard, all the porridge oats and the rice, and put it all in a bucket and put lots of water and stirred it all up and poured it all over his car. And I was completely out of control. And eventually, trying to deal with this monster, and it went on for years, I found myself in bed on my own one night, and this monster of jealousy was towering over me. This is 3 o'clock in the morning stuff. And it was getting bigger and bigger. It was like one of those, a Godzilla, if you like. And it was getting bigger and bigger, and I was getting smaller and smaller, pinned to the pillow. And so I thought, oh, I've got to do something. I'd been lying like that for an hour. So I said, right, I'm going to get up, make a cup of tea. And so then I thought, well, I will talk to it. And so I sat in one chair and I put it there. It was huge. And I basically said, I treated it eventually, took a long time, like a child. And I said, what is it that you really want? What is it you want? And basically it said to me, I've been trying to get you to listen to me all this time. So I've been shouting louder and louder and you won't listen. So, and then I found that it was, well, this is to cut several iterations of this technique short, but I found what was useful was to go and sit in its chair to get the answer. And then I would come back to my chair and say, well, what is it that, you know, what is it you wanted to say all this time? And I would go, it sounds mad, but I would go and sit in its chair and answer. And what it said was, this isn't, I want you to realise your value. And what you're doing in this jealousy is absolutely devaluing yourself. And this is your chance. If this was what your soul came here to do, this is your chance to do it. It's to value yourself, your qualities and your life. And so then I said, how? And then I phoned Anne. No. No. It said 2 hours a day for the first 6 months. 2 hours a day. And I'll tell you what to do. And it basically told me what to do. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done, to actually carry out that instruction. And I still often have to brush it up a bit, but it's, I think so many of us, particularly women, but not only women, are handicapped constantly by self-criticism. It absolutely slaughters us. It gets into, I mean, sitting here earlier, I was thinking, can I really do this? Oh, I'm not sure. Have I got the right clothes on? You know, all that stuff. And it just disables you. And it can disable you at the most crucial moment. So we need to take this issue seriously. And there's so much material now available for men and women to build a solid, realistic self-identity to enable us to be authentic. So that's my little dragon story.
Wonderful.
Yes.
One there and one.
Okay.
Have you got a?
Okay, good.
Yeah.
It seems to be on. I like your 10 commandments. Mm. They're a little bit more ecological than the Christian Jewish ones.
Mm-hmm.
But I also noted that the Northern American Indians, the Li laws of the Chinese, and the Ngara laws of the Aboriginals are very much like what you say.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now I have a question. Transparency is what really defines our era. Mm-hmm. Internet and stuff like that. Now transparency has a relationship with feedback and feed forward. And I would like to hear from you how you think these things work together.
Mm. Tell me how you, first of all, so I can answer it properly, what you understand by feedback and feed forward.
Feedback is that we look at the past or at the present and define our things. When you talk about the 3 month system of, yeah?
Short termism, yeah.
What you would say, on television they always say when there is a financial thing is that the results of the past don't matter. But we make them matter all the time. Mm. We buy stocks. Feed forward is creating a vision out there, having an idea of the future, which is much more effective.
Yeah.
And what I see with internet, cyberspace, is that the feedback is getting so fast that we get how do you call that, resonance, you know, it gets out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the major, major message that we should tell the world is to start looking ahead, have a vision that influences our life, and not looking back.
I'm absolutely with you. And it's quite difficult to find reliable visions. We need a Hildegard or Bingen or somebody. But what 16 of us older women are doing now, from all different cultures in the world, is developing each one's a specialist in some subject like economics, is drawing other economists around us and building a future, a clear idea of how local currencies could work, of how international finance could work, of how debt could work, etc. And there is already a lot of work going on out there, but it is not clear to the world how it could work. And what we want to do is to make clear these visions so that young people particularly have something to work towards. Because as Joe Rotblat notably said, the future belongs to those who can see it. And it then magnetises for...
Saint-Exupéry said, the future, our task is not to foresee, but to enable it.
Yes, thank you, exactly. So thank you for your question.
So many thanks for the talk. Three hopefully brief comments. Firstly, just in response to the vision issue, it's extraordinary how strategically we are focused on one particular sense and the metaphors associated with that sense, namely vision. There is no sense of listening to the future. There is no sense of tasting the future or anything like that. And I wonder whether some of that would build to a richer understanding of the future.
Absolutely.
My second comment is a bit of a tease, if you will, since you talk about transformative leadership. The extraordinary thing about leadership is the first four letters of the word, which are in fact led. And a sense of transformative leadership could well be understood, if you think of it in terms of lead, as an alchemical process. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about authenticity, you know, we're really looking not for leadership, but goldership.
There we are. He's got another point.
But my main concern is with list of 10 values. And I have a very systemic approach to things. And my question would be, from a cybernetic point of view, if you will, they constitute a system. And the question would be, what is missing from that system, from the 10? Mm-hmm. Why is it not 12 or some other number? Mm-hmm. And the specific one that I'm absolutely appalled is not present, is the sense, the value we hold, that the one thing we cannot challenge is the right of everybody to have as many children as they wish. Mm-hmm. And that you do not have built into that system, although it underlines many of the issues which you cited. Mm. But the recent report of the Royal Society on People on the Planet does not address our fundamental desire and right to have as many children as we wish.
Mm. Thank you. You and one here and one there, I think.
Yes, thank you, John Clapp. I'd like just to share a good news story. I'm very inspired by what we've heard this morning. I've been a former councillor in my hometown of Brighton and Hove. Last month in May, they made the historic decision, the council and the NHS, of a power-sharing agreement, which basically doubles the total amount of money to £1 billion a year. This is 300,000 people. To pool the budgets of health, social care, education and housing, so that money can be spent more wisely instead of in silos, mm-hmm. But to properly address the needs of disadvantaged people in all those ways. I put a paper 3 days ago to the Department of the Director of Public Health, which showed that if they diverted half the prescribing budget for drugs to meditation centres. I was very pleased that both speakers have emphasised the importance of meditation. Every pound spent on those meditation centres could actually save £7 I've done cost-benefit analyses for many years. I've never seen such a high return. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Yes.
Yeah. Why do you think wonderful, authentic, charismatic leaders are so rare? Do we fail to recognize them? Or when we recognize them, do we crucify them, put them in prison and shoot them? What is it that we don't have more of them? That's what we lack.
Yes. I think you're right. They are uncomfortable. You know that Mandela was very nearly condemned to death.
And Jesus was killed.
Yeah, exactly. So we could have...
Martin Luther King was shot.
Exactly. So we do go after the very strong in terms of their talent. I don't know how that can be avoided, because I was talking to a number of people from Syria on Monday, and I said to them, is there no leader of any stature in Syria today? And they shook their heads and said, no, absolutely no, nobody. And then I questioned them further. And eventually, after about 20 minutes discussion, they were both able to identify two people that they felt had the integrity, the authenticity, and the qualities of leadership who could manage to unite different factions. But it took them 20 minutes to think of those people. So they weren't well known, or they aren't yet. But I don't think we've got a system to grow leaders of this calibre. Because they're often uncomfortable people to be around.
Do they need to be willing to lay down their lives?
Yes, absolutely. They need to be willing to. And this is why I'm so encouraged by the locally led peace-building initiatives. Because these people that we work with are daily laying down their lives. And I'll just tell you one of them, which will give you a sense of how I see this leadership developing. Her name is not Malala Yousafzai, she works with Malala Yousafzai in northwestern Pakistan. Her name's Gululai Ismail, and she's in the similar region, this very, very violent region of northwest Pakistan. And when she was 15, she started an organization called Aware Girls. And what they did was basically to make it possible for young girls to go to school, for which Malala eventually got shot. And Gululai went on from there, she's now 26, to going into the madrasas, you know what the madrasas are, where the young men get educated, and identifying through talking to people which were the ones who were setting out to be jihadis, to be suicide bombers. And then she would very quietly get hold of them and say, can we go back and talk to your family? And she would go back with them and sit down with their family and talk them through the passages of the Quran which explicitly forbid such behaviour. And to my knowledge so far, she has prevented about 200 young men from becoming jihadis. Now, that's what I call a leader. And when I say to him, Gululai, aren't you afraid? And she said, if I was afraid, I couldn't do what I do. And I said, but you could be shot any day. Your colleague, Malala, was shot. And she said, well, if I'm shot, I'm shot. But I can't do anything else but what I'm doing, so I'll get on with it. And I think this generation that's emerging, and they're not all young, but the ones that have been identifiable as leaders in terms of preventing conflict or transforming conflict are the kind of leaders that we're talking about. This is why we try to nourish them. And I would love to be able to nourish them much more in terms of the spiritual and psychological and... Because they don't all by any means meditate, but they get their strength. A lot of them get their strength actually from nature. Particularly I'm thinking of leaders we work with in South Sudan. And they get their strength walking through the desert. So it is a reflective practice. It might not be what we would call meditation. But there is this powerful energy coming from the universe which inhabits these people.
And maybe it is just that, the willingness to die for your cause, that is the sort of power of the leadership.
Yes. And that is a kind of, in psychotherapeutic terms, it's an element of surrender. Because if you say, I'm prepared to die, you're surrendered to the worst that can happen. That we know, well, being tortured might be worse, but to surrender to death and the fact that you might die gives you enormous strength. Enormous strength. Because you've gone through the ultimate terror. Can I tell you another story? Have we got time?
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Henri Bourreladi, who was himself a child soldier in the Congo, and he escaped and ran through the bush for 5 days to eventually find safety with a Christian community. And he then became a Christian and wanted to do something to help the other children from the surrounding areas that were being abducted as child soldiers. And we got to know about him, and Peace Direct was able to send him very small amounts of money, I mean, like, say, $100. And he would take the money and ride his motorbike into the bush where the militia were hiding, and buy goats. And Henri is... He knows exactly what he's doing, because he knows that the militia are allergic to strangers, they're trigger happy, and they're high on drugs. So you go and visit them at your peril. So Henri arrives with this flock of goats, and he trades one goat for one child. The goat costs $5, and he brings the children home to their families. And then the difficult work begins, because you've got to integrate these children who've seen hell and been made to shoot people from their own villages, sometimes their parents, and you try to rehabilitate them. So that kind of work is what I call leadership. And who's ever heard of this? Well, actually, Mark Rylance did a play on Broadway about Henri, so people are beginning to take notice. So thank you for your question. And did you want to... Oh, sorry, yes.
Just relevant.
Oh, Sarita, hello.
Just relevant to this, last week I was with 85 people in Krakow. Okay. We went to Auschwitz together. And what I want to talk about is that we also created a ritual, just really creating rituals for our time. And one of them was to a ritual around inspiring leaders. So different people would stand up and speak about, bring to into our company, people doing remarkable, inspiring, great integrity, very moving. And there would be a meditation. We were all involved, we were all meditators and healers. And it was so moving. And it's something that we don't usually do. And these people who are not actually spiritual leaders, but they are spirit, you know, leading the spirit of our time.
Thank you. And it's a wonderful example of creating that unified field, your container, that you were creating for incredible things to grow out of. Thank you.
If I may tell a little story.
Please do.
This goes back to the time... Do you remember there was a bomb at Edgware Road Station? And all my clients cancelled, so I made my way back to Paddington. And as I walked towards Paddington Station, a policewoman came running out with a machine gun, saying, "Get out the effing way. There could be an effing bomb in there." And I walked straight up to her, got hold of her gun and pulled it down, looked her straight in the eyes and said, "You're supposed to be calming people, not frightening them." And tears appeared in her eyes and rolled down her cheeks. Gee, you're right. I'm so sorry. That's my story.
Thank you. Thank you. Lovely story.
Just a little question, and thank you so much for what you said. Can people hear me? Mm. How are we going to deal with the Chinese dragon? Shall we find the jewel under its claw, do you think?
Thank you. Well, this is a question that I absolutely welcome, because things are changing so fast in China right now. And I believe that we in the West have got in the habit of thinking of China as the terrifying aspect of the dragon. We repeat this mantra about one coal-fired power station being built every week. In fact, China's building more solar panels than any other country per capita in the world, making them cheaper and they work better. China is absolutely determined now to tackle both corruption and pollution. And they're also pioneering some very interesting work on education. So I don't have a rosy view of China at all, but I've worked there since 1978 in one way or another, and the change is vast. What the choice that China made, and I think probably wisely, was to try to stop people starving. And so back in the late 70s, early 80s, that's where all the effort went, was into stopping millions and millions of people dying of starvation. And that required a huge mobilisation of agriculture and industry.
Could I just say, have you heard of Glenn Schaefer?
Yes, he used to speak at
Glenn Schaefer years ago.
Yeah.
Went to China to study their agriculture and learned a great deal. He was an atomic scientist.
He was an atomic scientist, Glenn Schaefer.
Yeah.
He lectured at the Reakin Trust a while ago at Winchester. And he went and studied the actual agricultural new thing that they were doing, mm-hmm. whereby there was no pollution, no agricultural chemical of any sort, and because there are so many of them, they could work together, and I feel that's an example too.
Thank you. Absolutely. What I'd like just to say about the Chinese dragon is on this picture, and I wish I could, maybe I can project it up onto the screen in a moment later with my computer, but it's a picture of Kuan Yin, and she's the Chinese goddess of compassion. And she's standing in her bare feet on the scaly back of a huge red dragon thrashing its way through the sea. And this picture was on a scroll that rolled out of one of my cupboards in my living room 17 years ago, and I have no idea where it came from. But as soon as I saw it, I thought, there's something incredible about this. And actually, when you're able to see it, and I'll pass it round, it's a perfect illustration of the masculine and the feminine working together. Because the dragon in China is a sacred animal. He's an animal of great power and great good fortune. But he's also very fierce. And so Kuan Yin, who is the element of the deep feminine, she's poised, she's balanced, and she is pouring compassion out of a bottle into the sea of compassion, which is stormy. And so she's working perfectly with the masculine. And I think this is an image which, when I show it to the Chinese, they say, yeah, this is the future. This is the future. If I were allowed, I would tell you one last political... Can I have
Correct.
2 minutes?
We've got a bit of injury time, as it were.
An injury time. I was at a meeting of very, very senior political figures. If you think Kofi Annan, you're at the right level. And I had to brief them on Burma and Aung San Suu Kyi. This was when she was still under house arrest. And amongst them was the Chinese foreign minister. And so I started out on my briefing and I was calling the country Burma. And he interrupted me and he said, it's not Burma, it's Myanmar. And I said, well, let's compromise on Myanmar, Burma for the time being. And then the end of my talk, my briefing, which was 15 minutes, was to say that I felt that the way to get Aung San Suu Kyi released, this was before she was released, would be for China and India to put quiet pressure on the Burmese government. He went ballistic. He said, China never interferes with the international internal affairs of another nation. You should know that. This is terrible. This is bad advice. And I was appalled. And I didn't want to remonstrate with him, so I thought, well, it's better just to lay it to rest. And Desmond Tutu, who was the chair, said, let's have tea. And I went to bed that night in my hotel terrified that I'd caused an international incident, that the following day when the big launch was to happen, that the Chinese foreign minister wouldn't be there, that this would cause a media outcry. And I was so frightened that I took this card to bed with me and I prayed to Kuan Yin with all her power to help. Because I could sort of mentally hear the lines buzzing between where we were and Beijing and him being instructed to pull out. And Kuan Yin said, calm down. Calm down. You can go to sleep in the assurance that everything will be all right, but take the postcard with you tomorrow. So I did. I went to sleep. Went down to the launch. My heart in my mouth. And as the participants walked onto the stage, great relief, Chinese foreign minister was there. He made a very nice speech. Everything went off according to plan. I was just walking up the steps to the lunch arrangement, and he was walking down. And I saw this look cross his face as he saw me, that troublesome woman. And I saw him sort of slightly back off. So I took the postcard in my hand and I walked straight up to him and I said, Mr. his name, do you know this lady? And he said, it's Kuan Yin! She's coming back to China! And I said, yeah, I believe so. She's becoming very popular in China as the goddess of compassion again, because she's allowed. And he said, oh, she's with the dragon. And I said, yeah, this is... He said, I've never seen this picture before. And then I said to him, I believe you're a poet. And he said, yes. And he called his aide and he said, open the bag, open the bag. And he took out this volume of his poetry, all beautifully translated into English. And he opened it at the title page. And he said, what's your name? And I told him my name and he wrote, and all in Chinese figures. And when I got them translated, he dedicated it to me and he said, to the formidable lady. I think he meant her.
Yeah. Does somebody have the microphone still? No, I was about to speak.
I think we should have lunch, probably.
No, if you can... Is it appropriate?
It's difficult, actually. A difficult question to ask.
Well, go for it.
Probably she likes answer. Difficult questions.
Okay.
I won't say...
It'll be the last one.
I was very much at ease with your talk and attuned, and it's very humanitarian and... earth-orientated, that we're concerned about our environment. And I detected something in Peter Fenwick's question about consciousness after death and something through Anne Bering's talk about life of the universe. Now, in your talk, you used an example of blazing intelligence, the oak tree, which is an organism that's emerged on Earth over, a couple of billion years. I certainly agree with you there. There's an immense intelligence that's become integrated in this self-organizing, propagating organism. But do you see intelligence out there in the universe, or consciousness or awareness or responsibility out there in the universe other than on Earth?
You mean in space?
I want to ask you this. Yes, yes. I know many people do.
I do. Really just because of its immense beauty seen from here. I don't know what it looks like if you're out there, because I've never been out there in space. But when I look at these Hubble telescope pictures, one after another, there isn't an ugly one. It's just beauty after beauty after beauty. And it's breathtaking. So it has to be an intelligent universe, as far as I'm concerned, because it's so beautiful.
I see that as well, but nothing quite like life and nothing quite like consciousness.
I see what you mean. I can't help seeing it as consciousness, so I suppose I'm coming from a particular...
Can I answer?
Please.
What we can see with our senses is a tiny, tiny... Yeah. Reflection of the universe. Even if you look at light, you can see just tiny part of all the electromagnetic type of life. So what we see here and what science sees, if there is any life in the universe, we try to see life that exactly in the sense that we... But there is you don't know if there is other way to see that we don't see now. So there is huge intelligence, and you don't know if the sunshine is not intelligence that gives us love and wisdom and a lot of things, not just energy. So we don't know about this. We are too proud to think that we are the only intelligence.
Well, thank you very much. And I don't know about you, but I think some of the examples and stories that Scylla has shared with us, as well as the substance of her talk, is really humbling and awe-inspiring. And it shows what one person or a small group of people can do. And never doubt that a small group of people can change the world. It's the only kind of people, any group that does, is Margaret Mead. And so the power of this vision, an embodied vision, is incalculable. And I think this is one of the messages I'm going to be taking away from this morning, you know, not just from what you've been saying, Scylla, but also from what Anne was saying earlier on. And I think it's today you may well know that the One Spirit Alliance, which we are part of, was meeting in London. And so there's a similar group of people talking along similar lines. And I know that Serge Beddington-Behrens is going to be talking about awakening the global heart. And so we can maybe sort of link up, you know, subliminally with that meeting that's going on in London. And I think I get a sense of increasing power and confidence, if I can put it that way, that this power of focused intention of consciousness is something that will enable the leap that you've been talking about to take place. So can I couple my thanks to both you and Anne for a formidable and extraordinary morning? Thank you. Thank you.